and welcome to this podcast on the future of the Conservative Party and the battle of ideas currently raging in it. My name is Duncan Robinson, and I'm political correspondent at The Economist. And joining me are Nick Dennis, a Conservative councillor and the head of the policy at Tory Workers, which is a really interesting attempt to boost workers' rights in a Conservative way. And Rebecca Lowe. Rebecca Lowe is the director of FREEA, a new initiative promoting economically and socially liberal ideas based at the Institute of Economic Affairs, where she's also a research fellow. Rebecca is also a citizen editor and columnist at Conservative Home, so welcome both.
Hi.
We're recording this at 11 a.m. on Friday the 16th of November, and after coming back from Brussels with a seemingly very unpopular deal, Theresa May's future as leader of the party is in question. So everything may have collapsed while we're recording this, so we're going to try and take a step back, get our heads out of Westminster, and ask a simple question with big implications both for the Conservative Party and for Britain. And that question is, how do we set people free? Whatever happens in the coming weeks, it's an important question, and people have very different answers to it. And Nick and Rebecca both seem to have relatively contrasting views on it. So let's start there. How do we and should we set people free? Rebecca, do you want to start?
Sure. I should point out we are actually locked in a prison cell.
It's probably the safest place to be at this moment in time.
So we're forced to think about the big ideas rather than checking Twitter to see who's the latest resignation. Mm. I think this is a really interesting question about being set free. And obviously the work I do is with FREEA, where we're focusing on trying to push economically and socially liberal ideas back into the kind of political frame. I think it's pretty clear that we've seen a shift towards a more kind of paternalist style of government, particularly on the kind of social freedom side. We see the kind of the banny state, as it's becoming known. We're going to have a ban on the size of your pizza and no free poppadoms, sugar tax. And then on the other side, obviously, we also see a push towards sort of caps on energy price tariffs, and it's a general kind of suggestion that the state knows what's best for us and that it needs to intervene into our lives. Now, to my mind, the Conservative Party has, I mean, we can debate all day about this, but I think conservatism with a small c is a kind of responsive ideology, if it's an ideology at all. So it's not really surprising to me that over time the party has adhered to different kinds of ways of dealing with social and economic problems. At times it's been more kind of one nation paternalist, at times it's been more classically liberal. If you sort of look at Thatcher's time. So I don't really find that sort of divergence, or the divergence within the party, or the way in which its sort of main leadership or its main feeling, I'm not massively surprised that changes from time to time. I'm more interested in the more liberal side, in a sort of classically liberal way, and I think that's the right answer. I don't necessarily think that has to be delivered by the Conservative Party. I want that to be done by whoever the government of the day is. And I guess I find myself less interested in the party politics in that sense, and more interested in how the country should be run, what is a good country, what is a good society. So I guess that's my opening gambit, Nick.
Well, I suppose building on from that is, I ultimately see sort of the conservative politics as being about balance, really, and about stability, and in a sense doing the boring stuff to create an environment where individuals can be interesting and exciting. And you know, if you look at it in that way, you can marry up supporting Margaret Thatcher's agenda with John Major's agenda, and with a possible agenda. I wouldn't say Theresa May's agenda, because I think her and Nick Timothy has sort of set this agenda misunderstand what how the state should be proactive in helping people be free. And I agree that the banning stuff is basically a very non-creative way of trying to do this, really. But ultimately, when Margaret Thatcher took on the trade unions, who were too powerful at the time, what she was saying is that these people cannot set the agenda and control your life. They're not democratic. They have their own crazy ideas. I'm going to have to take them on, which meant that she had to operate in a more extreme way than maybe at another time, which is why, I think you might come on to this later, I get very frustrated when people now talk about Margaret Thatcher in the modern context, because it's just completely ridiculous, because modern context is very, very different. She needed to be extreme to stop an extreme, essentially. But I think we've got to the point now where I see civic institutions around me starting to fail. I see public spaces disappearing. I see instability happening, you know, crime numbers going up. And I really worry that one of the, you know, we're leaving the European Union and we're going out to the big wide world. One of the great things about our country is the fact that we're a stable, trusting nation. And this is starting to be eroded due basically to an obsession with financial spreadsheets. And ultimately, you know, I'm glad that the announcement of austerity ending has happened, and in the sense it has happened that we're not cutting more money anymore. But we really need to think about investing in our future and building those public services to let all people be free. Otherwise, we're going to end up in a sort of split society, which is quite a bleak place.
So it seems like you're arguing that the state is a mechanism for making people free, and you seem to be arguing that the state is something that needs to get out of the way for people to be free.
That's an interesting way of putting it. Yeah, I mean, I guess, to my mind, I mean, I'm not an anarchist. I think there are some things the state should do. But I do think that organised society is predicated on consent, and I think that there are limits, and what the state has to do should be justified. And I like what Nick says about worrying when sort of non-democratic power gets in the way, and I think the example of Thatcher is a very good one. To my mind, I think, as your point about civic institutions, and I guess the role of like voluntary organisations, the role of the individual, there's a sort of set of kind of concentric circles, I think, in terms of, you know, if we put the central state, and then we have some wider ways in which society can be run or be helped to be run. Mm-hmm. One thing that worries me a lot, and I find myself concentrating on this almost all of the time when I think about maybe the ways in which we could deal with some of the problems we have, and that's the highly centralised state that we have in this country. I mean, you just need to look at the example of taxes. I mean, we are insanely fiscally centralised. I think it's sort of 95% of our taxes. I mean, that's the standard stat the OECD gives. I think if you actually look at it, though, the taxes which aren't centralised, so if you look at the way in which business rates are calculated, or if you look at council tax, actually less autonomy has been, so the autonomy that the local areas had has actually been taken away from them.
And as a local council, I'm shaking my head, that's completely true.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you look at this, we're at best an outlier, at worst, we're getting something seriously, seriously wrong in terms of, I mean, you know, the economic arguments are very, very strong in terms of, you know, matching preferences, the Thibault sorting kind of stuff in local areas. Everything I've read anyway suggests that decoupling revenue raising from public spending in local areas is crazy. That doesn't lead to economic growth. You need for that to be recoupled. But aside from those, I think even if the economic arguments, and this is where I guess I'm slightly different from some of my free market friends, in that I don't think that economic growth is everything. And this, you know, this to my mind is why I voted for Brexit, actually. I think that some things are more important. And to my mind, those things which are most important are those key political and civil or civic sort of rights and freedoms. And I think that's where it all has to be grounded. And if democracy is not working in the sense that, you know, oh, nobody's going out and voting for the local councillor because they realise the local councillor can't do anything, not even set some tax rates. I mean, sure, there's economic benefits, tax competition, I'm mad about all that stuff, but the key point has to be these points about these key political rights of democracy.
For me, what's very, very important, I sort of, in a sense, I do agree with a lot of what you're saying, Rebecca. Mm. Obviously, we are on a similar sort of area of the political spectrum, that isn't surprising. But
sure.
But the sort of important detail that I would put in there is that you need state investment, you need public service in order to allow that to happen. And as a local councillor, the best work that we do is when there's a combination between, you know, us as elected members, a local community group, and the council giving money and expertise. And it's all those three things all working together creates the best outcomes. Because local initiatives, they need the infrastructure, they need the support, they need the organisation. So, you know, I was very interested in Big Society. I think the Big Society concept, even though I hate the name of it, sort of drew me into the Conservative Party. I joined in about 2006. I was interested in politics, didn't have a political home. I thought, well, I've got to be part of the party because actually that's where politics is at. And it was just when David Cameron first came leader of the Conservative Party, I looked at different choices and in the end joined the Conservative Party. And I've not looked back since. But the Big Society was the main element. But for me, the Big Society didn't work because I don't think Cameron and Osborne really understood it. They sort of they knew it was a good thing, but they didn't understand it instinctively. And what they didn't understand is what they needed to do was break up the state, but not break up the state to cut it back, but break up the state to distribute it and its power. Because the problem you have with Whitehall is that it's big Whitehall likes dealing with big businesses. So you end up with big sort of public sector contracts, obviously Serco and Carillion, because essentially selling big to big is very, very easy. Mm. It's a lot more effort to break those contracts down to local providers, get local communities involved, all this sort of stuff in order but it creates a more resilient network and a more connected network. One of my great frustrations with the way the state operates is how tax breaks are offered to companies who set up factories here and there and everywhere. Mm-hmm. And while I don't disagree with doing that in a sense, if somebody wants to do an employee ownership type of, if a group of employers want to take over their own business and run it themselves, they get no support, no financing at all. Charities get hardly any support. I mean, and the ones that get the most support are the bigger ones as well. So really what we need to do is I agree with you, the decentralisation and breaking up the state, but rather than taking money away to say we've cut the deficit down, what we need is to give money to the people so they can use it themselves in their own way.
It feels like we're in a situation where the state is large but hollow. So it's sort of everywhere it shouldn't be, but not as efficient as it should be where it is, which is a peculiar situation.
That's right. I mean, public spending is very high. It's around 41% share of GDP.
But it doesn't feel that way.
No, and I think part of that reason is the kind of disproportionate way in which some of the cuts were enacted, particularly in the sort of the Cameron years. And I think part of the problem is that indeed some of those cuts hit local areas pretty heavily. You look at kind of funding policing budgets, etc.
Where people interact with the state.
Exactly.
Libraries, for example.
Yeah, exactly. The things where, you can actually experience it, you can actually see it and feel it.
The tangible state.
That's a nice way of putting it. I like that. Exactly. I think, though, ostensibly to me, there are kind of two points here. One is a point about the overall level of public spending. And the other is a point about the way in which public spending is done, or the way in which who is it makes the choices. And I guess this brings us on to the whole sort of nationalisation, privatisation debate, which is kind of raging at the moment. Mm-hmm. And to my mind, again, that seems like a bit of a... It's almost like a bit of a false dichotomy, because within that you have all kinds of questions about, okay, fine, something is nationalised, or something is privatised. And we know what that means in big senses, in terms of who it is who owns it, but within that you also have the point, who is it who runs it, who is it who makes the decisions, who is it who actually are the workers within that,
who are the shareholders, who gets the profits,
who, etc. These kind of questions down, and I think we often miss those questions. So it's a question about where the money comes from, or what level the money is, but then who it is who does stuff with that, or how it's done.
But that's when ideology takes over. So I mean, in very broad terms, I'm very much into private and free enterprise and individual freedom, but only where it can really exist. So I'm perfectly happy and comfortable with private sector companies being involved in the NHS and providing services.
Sure.
My left-wing friends will say to me, well, how can you support companies making profit from death? And I say, well, that's why you're socialists, you don't understand. Companies make money from doing good, so companies will be making money from keeping people alive. If the drivers are set correctly. What I disagree with, I just can't get my head around the concept of something like electricity or water can be private, because ultimately that is, there's one pipe going to my house and the water is the water. So the idea that we privatise something like that creates essentially, a sort of basically a bunch of people who can easily get rich off a monopoly.
Like, so there is this kind of classic argument, isn't there, that something where there's a natural monopoly, one pipe, let's say, that you can't, that just can't be privatised. I think to counter that, though, there are ways in which, I don't know, you talk about the way that it's measured. It's not just the supply, the literal supply in terms of the water coming through the pipe, which needs to be done, right? It's also the way in which you record how it's done, or the way in which it's, bulked off here. And actually, I mean, I think businesses do get to choose between water providers, don't they? I mean, my point is,
How is profit made? Because government gives money to do a service. Company says, I'll do that service, and then they take money from the government as profit. I mean, I can see where profit can be made in terms of the NHS, but not...
So my problem largely with, you look at something like, I mean, the trains, I guess, are the real classic example everyone wants to come back to on this. And to my mind, the problems are from the fact that it hasn't been liberalised sufficiently. Everybody says, oh, the trains are rubbish because they're privatised. Well, in what way are the trains prioritised? For a start, we have a split between track and train. Secondly, if you look at train, where actually there have been some improvements. I mean, depending on how you measure, I mean, more people use it. If you want to travel at 3 a.m. in the morning, you can probably get on some random route, you can probably get a cheaper ticket. But really, the only point where competition comes in is in the franchising system. So you come along and you'll say to the government, oh, well, I'm going to provide it like this, I'm going to provide it like this. That's the point of competition. That means that the consumer, the person who ideally should be there and you should be seeking to please the consumer, is the state. So it's effectively a monopoly and a monopsony. Yeah, and this is not privatisation.
But I don't see how you can really truly privatise the railways, to be honest. I mean, and this is probably where we're going to fundamental difference. I mean, I think as you know, what we should be doing is we should be creating a state which is to allow freedom to flourish, and travelling and the ability to travel to work and travel where you want to go to is so important that I think the state should always have that as a sort of part of the equal framework. I mean, you know, I look at, you know, the best bus service in the UK is in London, where it's run by...
It's a very good point. Most people, yeah. You know, we're sitting here in Westminster talking about trains. Most people don't use trains outside of London. I mean, there's if you look at those nice little maps people like Tom Forth do on the internet, you look at it, what's a train?
I mean, when I first came to London, I was amazed by the buses. They were the most amazing things ever. Yeah. 24 hours a day, I could get to anywhere I wanted to. I'm coming from a place, you know, I grew up in Cambridgeshire, which is, you know, nice enough, not too far away from London. But my God, if you wanted to get to anywhere after 6 p.m., you had a real massive struggle. Yeah. And I think that was really unfair in terms of creating that sort of level playing field. So, you know, I would say for something like transport, actually the government should get involved.
This is the point. This is this kind of underlying normative question. And again, like you sort of intimated earlier, people on the left sometimes want to say, you know, the state should do this.
Yes.
It's only right that the state does this. Now, there are two reasons why you might think that. You might just fundamentally think that should be something the state does.
Yeah.
But I think most people probably aren't thinking on that level. I think they're more thinking that because that's going to provide a better service. And that's why I worry, because when the state provides these things, often it leads to X inefficiency. There's no real incentive to drive up standards. There's no competition, which naturally helps to do that.
But if you look at the areas where nationalisation is very, very popular, it's in the quote-unquote natural monopolies. It's energy, water, and then slightly less railways, where it's, as you say, much, much more arguable. But at the other end of the scale, nobody wants to renationalise Vodafone. Nobody wants to renationalise British Airways. The notion of the British state having an oil company is insane.
Thomas Cook, wasn't it?
Or
betting shops. I remember when I was in my 20s and stuff. I mean, I'm in my late 30s now, but even better, we had the state-owned betting shops. Mm.
But this is the thing, people forget how big and powerful the state used to be before Margaret Thatcher. And so we're in a situation now where there's 25, 30 years of people's own experience, and they know where it works, and they know where it hasn't quite worked. And so now it seems, judging by the fact 85% of people want water to be nationalised, they say, okay, we'd rather try something else. So from that point of view, could a Conservative Party come round on those on that issue? And if it can't, to what extent is that simply due to ideology?
That's a great question. I mean, and I think it comes back to the point of looking where the actual problems are. Mm. And I think all too often, largely because of these things, we don't really want to call them ideology, whether we want to think about it in terms of, you know, parliamentary arithmetic or the way in which following the polls and all that stuff, which I find quite depressing. I mean, I'm interested in these ideas because I think they're good and they're right, and I think politicians should follow them because I think they're good and they're right, not because it's going to get them a leap in tomorrow's YouGov or whatever it is. And then I think all too often we are distracted, partly because vested interests, politicians wanting to continue this narrative, that narrative, because it works well for them. We don't look and say, well, look, is this working? Will this work? Can this work? What are the actual problems? I think we're not very good at diagnosing problems. And particularly, I mean, if you look at the Conservative Party, something like the NHS, it's just completely thrown. It's not even going to get in there. Yeah. Never mind trying to work out what the actual problems are. Clarification, justification, working out what the problems are. That's what I want to see politicians doing.
So I'm going to be a bit extreme in my answer to this question. But I think basically the top of the party, and maybe the party as a whole, is ideologically bankrupt. And it's ideologically bankrupt in the sense that it's still trying to sort of fit itself to an ideology that doesn't really work anymore, but doesn't know what to do in order to get out of it.
What is that ideology?
Well, that ideology is some sort of perverted version of Thatcherism, which
do
I think so. Yeah, yeah.
Because I think the point to my mind, the problem with the Cameron years was that there wasn't really any ideology. I mean, I guess in that sense, I think he was an actual conservative. And, like, sure, maybe we can say we know that these people had these views and these people had these views, but certainly in terms of the big scale policy prescriptions, I think it was often lacking any kind of justification. Now, if you want to call that ideology or if you want to call that reasoning, I don't really care. Ideology has you know, comes with unloaded terms. But like something like, I don't know, you want to address welfare, for instance, like indeed that incitation of the government tried to do. Now, there are loads of reasons why you might want to do that. You might say, welfare spending is too high, and this means that people don't have any incentive to go out to work. And work is good because it helps communities, it gives people a sense of responsibility.
Yeah.
You don't say, we're going to cut welfare to save money. I mean, that just... Not only does it lead the other side open to bash you, it's just not a justification.
And so Cameron offered a sort of bargain basement politics.
It leaves you open to attacks, but it's also just not justified in a democracy.
As a local councillor, I can tell you very much that the cost gets displaced. You know what I mean? If cuts, you know, you have, the other parts of the state have to pick them up. But I remember at a Tory party conference, maybe, I think it might have been 2011 or 2012, and there was a new person elected as the head of Conservative Future, which was the old name for the Conservative Young People. It was a guy called Ollie Cooper. I don't know if you know, but I know, very nice guy. But he basically, in his opening statement, was very proud to say that I paid for my own business cards because I wanted Margaret Thatcher on the back of my business cards because that is, you know, the party wouldn't pay for them. And I just sat there and I was just so depressed. I was thinking, well, of course, you know, I'm into history and it's all very important knowing where we've come from. But that is not the future. You know, she was dealing with these big beasts of unionism, communism, all this sort of stuff. But to sort of, you know, and then you often get this within the Tory party. You get a bunch of people who you know, younger people, I hate using that phrase, it shows you how I'm getting old now, but younger people sort of hark back to what would Thatcher do, and this is Thatcherism. Mm. But because of the way the party is, it's basically been hollowed out in terms of its membership, it's been hollowed out in terms of people who are interested in it. So all that's left within it, essentially, are people who cling on to this sort of misunderstanding of how Thatcher operates in the government, I would say, which means actually we can't deal with the problems in the proper way. And I agree with you that Cameron and Osborne, essentially Cameron wanted to grab onto something, so he grabbed onto this big society idea. He didn't really feel it or understand it, which is why it ultimately didn't work.
I mean, if you read anything like, you know, Jesse Norman's writing at the time, these interesting ideas of communitarianism, and
indeed.
You know, whether or not you agree with that, there was something there to be offered. And it's got kind of voluntary.
For me, I think Brexit's really interesting because actually Brexit really shows this disconnect, because the Vote Leave message really was about two things. It was about a bunch of things, but two of the very, very important things were more money to spend on your public services, that NHS bus thing, which basically means people want more investment in the public services they care about. And the second thing was this thing called take back control. Now, what does take back control mean?
Yep.
Well, take back control in the referendum was very simple. We vote to change the system, yeah? But as soon as the referendum ended, the Conservative Party went back to complete old politics. Where was the consultation? Where was bringing people in? Where was looking at things differently? Now, I would argue, and I'm a big fan of the sort of citizen assembly, citizen jury idea, I would argue, you know, Brexit should have been done in that sort of way, where essentially the state should have been used to form areas where people could express opinions in an intelligent way with the facts there, not as a mob, basically. But that's how I would translate take back control. But the Tory party and the Labour party, in their different way, I can talk about how I'm disappointed with them as well, but went back and dissolved. And now we're in this really big mess where people in Westminster are shouting at each other. People outside Westminster don't care, apart from, who the hell are you? Why can't you deliver this thing we've said? And that's because they haven't actually got to grips with the ideology that's needed for the world as it is now.
One thing Theresa May tried to do, this is with the caveat that she's still Prime Minister at the time of recording, it felt like she tried to turn the Conservative Party into a more Christian Democrat-style party, a more sort of European-style centre-right party with the sort of sharp edges, the sharp elbows of Thatcherism sort of rounded off, and that was something that Osborne seemed to really revel in. This seems to be economically compassionate. So that Cameron was socially compassionate, this is economically compassionate. Given that polling sort of seems to indicate that people are okay for the first time in a while with higher taxes if it goes towards public services, do you think that there is still some mileage in that worldview?
That's interesting. I mean, the social democrat model, I guess, in terms of whether it's the sort of embracing the kind of social market approach where you feel that private enterprise is important, but you also feel there's a space, I guess it's the kind of, particularly in Germany, it's the kind of auto-liberal idea, yes, there, where you have a space for regulation, a space to make things work. And I think most modern economies do work in that kind of way. I mean, sometimes, you know, we talk about, oh, we have free market here and there's a command economy here. I mean, you know, every decent sort of modern working economy is a mixed model. And I don't really think that's going anywhere anytime soon. I don't think we're going to get rid of regulation, but I would say at this point, however, that the tax and regulatory burdens are so extremely high in this country, and I worry particularly about the effect on poorer people. So, I mean, if you look particularly at the, and this is another way I think where we differ from our sort of OECD neighbours, and that's the fact that I think 2/3 of the tax take comes from income tax, national insurance, and VAT. If you look at the actual rates of taxation people paying, when you look at the whole of the tax that's employed, because obviously national insurance is just a tax, there's no like bulk which you can go and drag into. I think the rates are something like around 40% for basic, and then 49 and 53 for higher and additional. I mean, that's insanely high. In terms of the way in which the government intervenes to help people, if you look at the disparity between like the top and the bottom in terms of sort of take-home pay before anything has happened to it, it's around 12 times or something. Then when you look at cash transfers and taxation, our system is very progressive. It deals with around 5 times. But then if you look at things like indirect taxation, which hits the poorest people the hardest, I really, really worry about the kind of cost of living crisis we have from this vastly high level of taxation, and also the kind of increasingly unfair level of taxation. And I think, so I, to that end, I just don't really see where further there is to push on it. But it's also a great question of how the tax works.
You mentioned taxes on income and taxes on consumption, but you didn't mention potential taxes on wealth, which would be one way of recalibrating the tax system.
I think, you know, our tax system is insanely complicated. It's something like 24,000 pages, the tax code. We could, if you want to give different numbers, probably because nobody's actually read the 24,000 pages. It's massively, massively complicated, which I think is anti-democratic for a start, and particularly unfair for those people who are less well-informed. In terms of wealth taxation, I mean, look, I want to rejig the whole tax system in so many ways. So one thing, for instance, I'd get rid of all the kinds of stamp duty, all of these kind of property taxes, and bring in one specific land value tax. You know, we can, again, debate all day whether that's the right way. And we can do the same thing about wealth taxation. I actually think probably the best way to do it is to put a wealth tax on it. But I think addressing some of these other things, like land value, a really good way of starting and addressing some of the disparities we see. I just think we probably need to start fresh, but that's not really very pragmatic.
I think we do.
A year zero tax
policy. I think undoubtedly we do need to start fresh on tax policy, because essentially it's lots of people tinkering, have created this
making
mess.
It worse.
It's like the sort of bonfire of the quangos. We created 4 extra quangos. No other quangos got cut away. But I mean, for me, again, this comes back to the way the top of politics, and I think on the Labour side as well, are just completely missing how the real world operates, and which is why there's all this disenchantment with politics. So ultimately, people want the environment where they can be best off, and when they say they mean their families and their friends, and as well as themselves. And that does involve taxation of public services, and does involve keeping your own money and spending it as well. I think most people, that's what they feel and that's what they want. So when they answer questions in polls like the one you put, Duncan, I mean, it's sort of, I think we should look at the answer in the broader terms. You know, essentially they want things to get better, and they're quite desperate to try anything to make it better. But the current way the government seems to operate these things is a couple of percentage points extra here, a couple taken over there, and that doesn't really make any difference, because what you're not doing is you're not actually giving people the ability to affect their own lives. And Labour are just as bad as this. So, you know, John McDonnell, when he came up with his share scheme, for example, and you know, I'm a massive fan of enabling employee ownership, and I think it's a really, really important underrated activity that we've not invested enough in. But really what he was doing is he was trying to use the language of take back control, but then shift it ultimately into his own sort of communist outlook, where that would ultimately get transferred to the state in the end.
It's just going to end up costing people, and only
a certain amount of workers who work for the richest companies will probably have the best job security and contracts anyway, you know. So
stealing stuff from shareholders, and you know, if you're going to end up, you know, taking down people's wages.
It wasn't freedom to take back control. It's basically a different form of I know best, and you know, Theresa May and Nick Timothy, who was behind her, who was her brains apparently, if that's the right way to describe his outlook on the world. I mean, they were right in the narrative. They were right in the burning injustices that people wanted to be solved. But what they didn't at all get to grips with or understand is the reason how you solve that is by giving people control and power. And if you look at how they've done Brexit, for example, we know what Brexit is. Brexit means Brexit, trust us, da 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 da. Well, actually, no, you didn't know what Brexit means. And you said that no deal, you know, is better than the bad deal. Well, you know, I mean, even I, who begrudgingly probably would accept this deal at the moment, would say that basically the reason for accepting it is because no deal seems to be worse than what is at the moment a bad deal. But also at the same time, if you look at how they put together the Conservative manifesto as well at the 2017 election, the reason why it imploded is because a very, very small group of people who thought they were very, very clever tried to write this big document and put it out there. You know, if they would have actually consulted in a more open, wide way, you know, a lot of the issues that came up, such as the you know, the social care sort of levy on homes, you know, they showed that to any MP worth anything at all, and they would say, I can't sell this on this doorstep, it's too complicated, duh, duh, duh. And that was because essentially of this closed manner of doing things. So while Theresa May has talked a good talk, and I think she, verbally she was in the right place, again there was a complete lack of understanding of the radical thing that needs to be done to put politics back where the people are.
That's right. Particularly, I mean, the thing I just feel very depressed about at the moment is I just feel as if the political establishment, and by that I guess I mean well, Theresa May, because she basically is the executive and everything else.
She's a very presidential prime minister.
She is incredibly.
She's a weak prime minister, yeah, but yeah, she's extremely presidential.
Yeah, she works for us. It's astonishing. But also, I mean, parts of the civil service and the general machine, I feel as if they just don't understand that. I think for a lot of people voting for Brexit, it wasn't about short-term economic stuff. I mean, I voted for Brexit knowing that there probably would be short-term economic problems, but that cannot be everything. It's come back to my point about what the underlying justifications and principles are. If we see again that, you know, ordered society is based on consent, and that's not just because we think it's going to give good results, but because we are autonomous creatures who deserve to have that, and that's how democracy works, then I just feel there's been a complete misunderstanding that this was not about short-term economic benefits or losses. This is about something so much more. It's about being able to, you know, vote for politicians who then, you know, work on legislation. It's about not being under the jurisdiction of a foreign court. These are fundamental points about how our society should work and where our voice is within that.
That's very interesting, because there's one underreported trend, I think, which is this growth of what I like to call post-growth politics. People, maybe it's because growth gave
the
up
donut
on
donut stuff. And
yeah,
all
yeah. People are happy now to take this policy path where everyone agreed it's probably not going to make you any richer, and it manifests itself. It's difficult to build houses. It's difficult to build infrastructure in the UK. All these policies that boost GDP struggle for support.
I've got a theory about that, and the theory is essentially, while in many aspects of our life we are richer, you know, clothes are cheaper, generally food's generally cheaper,
smartphones,
I you know, Netflix and all this sort of stuff, the reality is those things that give us stability and deep down comfort, such as housing, such as health, such as education, you know, either are becoming more and more expensive, or we can see them becoming more and more eroded. Mm-hmm. So while in one sense we are getting, or have been getting, maybe richer, you know, slightly richer on a percentage point level, the reality is we've seen the sort of comfort, stability of our lives being taken away from us, and also pensions and working longer, which is where the deeper unhappiness comes.
I mean, I think that, so my point about not just being about short-term economic benefit is that you can't always just judge things in terms of what the economic consequences are going to be. I know a lot of people who say, hey, we want to trade away some of our political freedom, democracy and stuff, so we can always have better economic growth. I don't buy into that. But I'm massively interested in economic growth, and I think that growth is something, you know, growth has been slow. And I think in the longer term, I do believe that if we have proper Brexit and we have, you know, control yeah. over how we do things, I think it will lead to, you know, better enterprise, it'll lead to better trade, it'll lead to all kinds of new forms of growth, and I don't think the growth itself is within the EU. But that's and all I'm saying is that wasn't my reasoning. I think it was and wasn't a lot of people's reasoning for why it was they wanted to leave. It was a more fundamental democratic point.
I mean, one of the questions that people often ask is, why did you vote to leave in this area when you get lots of EU funding? Well, I don't want to be a charity, and I think Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, basically what they decided to do is they decided to make the UK the sort of most liberal part, the biggest single market in the world, and what that meant was basically selling at financial services and all this sort of stuff, which made Southeast London a really sort of rich and area. But at the same time, other areas fell behind. You couldn't access that. So what they did is they sort of gave them funding and increased public sector pay and all this sort of stuff. But really, actually, that didn't improve people's opportunities or lives, and didn't make them feel good about themselves, and didn't feel like they actually had control in their lives. And so I think what people were voting for is they were voting for to sort of get away from that and rebalance the economy. So again, I don't think the sort of question is an interesting one. It's one that pollsters sort of put out, people talk about, but the reality is people do want to get rich and be able to buy more stuff and have a happier life. But what they see is a system that, while on paper might look better and better and better for them, it's not giving them the satisfaction, their families, the opportunities they believe. I mean, I'll finish this point. If you look at any survey about do people think the UK will be better or worse in 10, 15 years' time, vast majority of people are saying they think it's going to be worse.
I think I really interested your point about saying that you don't want to be a charity. And I think one of the things that worries me about the EU, and another reason why I voted to leave, is some of my friends would say, oh, but we do disproportionately well. We get more funding here or than this country, or more funding there. Is that fair? I worry about that other country in Europe. I think the way in which the EU has gone, particularly since the embrace of the euro, has been absolutely disastrous for a lot of people. You look at youth unemployment in Greece, Italy, you look in France, you look at the rise of populism, often because people are voting for parties because they're Eurosceptic. You look at the way in which 45% of people voted for in the first round of the presidential election in France last year, voted for Le Pen and for Mélenchon. And I'm pretty sure the reason for that was because they were offering Eurosceptic policies. Now, people then didn't go on and do it, but there was a point, and people's cutoff point about where they're willing, the basket of things that politicians stand for, that they're willing to accept, that's growing. And they're saying, well, actually, but I'm so frustrated about this that I'm going to embrace, even in a small way, this terrifying person. You look at the AfD and the Bundestag. I really, really worry, and I didn't want to be part of that. I want to be outside of that because I think it's fundamentally undemocratic, but I also think its economic policies have been absolutely disastrous.
Yeah. I mean, I voted Remain mainly because I didn't think it was worth the hassle.
I care about my fellow Europeans.
Being a sort of policy wonk, I sort of early on clocked the amount of effort and energy it would involve. But I do agree that I think the sort of structure and the institutions of the EU is on the wrong side of history.
I don't want to be part of that. And, I want to be outside from it so that we can help undeniably comes crashing down.
The moment when I feel most passionate about leaving is when I see the negotiation teams between us and the EU, and basically the EU is all 50-year-old white men in sort of very nice suits, and I know we're not necessarily the most diverse, but we have a lot more diversity, and it just reminds me of how politics is still done in Europe.
We forget about this. You look at just over the last couple of months, you look at what's happening in the Central European University in Hungary, you look at what happened, Italy elected politician comes up with some economic policies and the EU comes along and says, hey, no guys, you're not allowed to do that. I mean, we all too often, we think about the rhetoric of the EU, we think about these nice ideas that came out with Churchill and all these good ideas, all these good people, about unity, and we have these democratic peace theses, and those are all very nice. But if you look at the way in which the EU actually acts, if you look at the actions rather than its rhetoric, it's pretty scary.
I mean, Macron's very interesting because when he came out of nowhere, he sort of started a sort of momentum type of sort of grassrootsy thing.
Right.
But as president, he's been extremely centralising and
very Napoleon
and very Napoleonic.
The sky is the limit. He's playing people off against each other in the run-up.
Exactly.
Like, we're going to do this, going to do that. It's like what the Dems used to do before they worked out what actually happens if you get voted in on that kind of thing. And now, look at his approval ratings.
Which is really odd because obviously he was a new, freshing, and I liked his campaign, but now he's even more centralised, Benny. The Warren Hole of Europe and Brexit.
It's difficult to escape Brexit's gravity. We'll try and reach escape velocity.
We've even locked ourselves in a cell, and we're still back to Brexit.
So let's try and steer clear for a final question. There is likely to be a leadership battle within the Conservative Party at some point. It may have even started. Who knows? We're in jail.
What we
But if you found yourself transplanted and suddenly found yourself as leader of the Conservative Party, what would be at the top of your manifestos? What would be your number one priority?
Oh, I suppose right. I'd go back to the devolving thing that I talked about. So I'm a big fan of citizens assemblies and citizen juries, and I'd set up structures to do that. I'd also task the civil service with every single big contract they have. They'd be tasked to having to see how they could break it up and offer it to different types of entities. I'd also put financial backing behind employee ownership type of schemes and all those type of stuff in order to sort of, shall we say, more democratize the way and sort of tax breaks and other things are done.
You'd Corbynize the Conservative Party?
No, because what I'd be doing is putting in the structures in place for people to do what they wanted to do. This idea, you know, the top two, every firm with over 250 employees has to sort of be share ownership and unions coming. I mean, that's just the other side of the sort of status out touch coin. No. I'd be creating the environment that people could choose.
Give them the choice.
Yeah, I'll give them the freedom. But you need to invest and put the structures in there to give them that freedom.
Sort Brexit in a way in which, you know, we can do our own, well, all of the things I think which were in the terms and conditions of voting for Brexit. And I think the one that everyone always forgets about is ECJ jurisdiction. I mean, the rubbish that people talk about this and the lack of understanding, I think, is frustrating. But I want, you know, be able to do international trade deals, looking to, you know, set up free ports in local areas, all that kind of thing, decentralising. Starting with the tax system in some of the most basic ways in terms of recoupling revenue raising, and then also looking at some of the stuff like, you know, where, what are the other things, like Sunday trading, some basic stuff where we can start. I think it's going to take time to decentralise in that way and in other ways. Cutting tax, abolish Public Health England, that's going to be pretty high on my list of things, I think. Save what, £4.5 billion and get off people's backs about eating pizza. pretty good start for me.
There's a crying call for liberty there.
I think so.
Well, fantastic. Well, thank you both so much for taking the time to talk us all through that. That was absolutely fascinating, and we should all make our own bit for freedom now and get out of this jail cell.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Rebecca.